I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In politics, even more than most other human endeavors, it isn't over till it's over, no matter what the newspapers say. Just ask President Dewey. Sometimes it isn't even over after the polls have closed and the votes have been counted. Ask President Gore about that one. And it may be extremely premature to use poll numbers this early in the campaign to predict what might happen in November. Just ask President Dukakis about what happened to his springtime lead. But none of that is stopping us this hour as we look at the political implications of the war in Iraq. How do you think the ongoing conflict will affect the presidential race between George Bush and challenger John Kerry? Is the steady drip of bad news from the post-war battlefield causing you to reconsider your vote for president? And whoever is elected in November, what course do you want him to pursue in Iraq? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have several guests this hour to help us sort out the impact that post-war Iraq is having on American voters. But first, we want to check in with Dan Murphy, who is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He's joining us from Baghdad. Hi, Dan, and welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
What is the latest where you are?
What's the latest? I think everybody's eyes are on Fallujah, the Sunni triangle town where there's been so much fighting and killing over the past week. A ceasefire has sort of gone into a second day, and there are negotiations, or that may be too strong a word, but members of the Iraqi political establishment are communicating between U.S. forces and insurgents inside the town, trying to find some sort of negotiated solution, which in the end will look very, very unlikely because both sides are very dug in and committed to positions that are 180 degrees away from each other.
And Dan, do we know anything more about the hostages? There are now seven Chinese men who have been taken, plus the three Japanese who were taken last week.
There's those two groups, and then there are a couple of others. There's a couple of Arab Israelis from Jerusalem who are working with coalition contractors who are taken. There's probably 20 to 25 people who have been taken hostage in various locations over the past week, and we know very, very little about exactly who has taken these people and what's being done. The Chinese tried to drive through Fallujah from Jordan to Baghdad, it seems. We don't know why they were coming yet, but we have no word on their fate or on negotiations to release them as of yet.
Is it at the point now where no foreigner, certainly no American, feels very safe walking the streets these days?
It is certainly the case. This is something that began, let's say, 6 weeks ago. There have been a number of minor incidents with foreigners in various cities. I've been away from Iraq for a long time. When I came back, the mood had changed. Now it has really gotten worse in the past week and 10 days. And a month ago, I would go almost anywhere in Iraq, taking the proper precautions to travel by day, et cetera. Now, every time I think about putting a foot outside of my hotel, I go through what could go wrong and what I have to protect myself. So foreigners are dramatically curtailed in their activities, even compared to a couple of weeks ago.
You also write today about what didn't happen in Karbala this weekend. Why was that important?
What hasn't happened in Karbala, or what has happened, conversely, is that militias close to more moderate, let's say, political forces within the Shiite establishment here pushed out the forces of the militant Muqtadir al-Sadr, who ignited the Shiite uprising against the coalition forces in a number of central and southern cities a week ago Sunday. And essentially, they pushed him out of this city, which is having a very, very important Shiite religious celebration, celebrating the martyrdom of Imam Hussein almost 1,400 years ago. That's one good thing. And the other good thing is there simply weren't any suicide attacks or terror attacks there on the huge crowds, as has unfortunately become common on major religious festivals inside Iraq.
Well, Dan, we trust you will keep taking those precautions and hope you'll stay safe.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for joining us. We turn now to Richard Wolff. He is Newsweek's Washington correspondent and author of the Swing Vote article in this week's edition. He's with us now from Washington. Welcome, Richard.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Well, we appreciate your joining us. What do your latest numbers show about the impact that all of this is having?
Well, the headline figures are the most striking in a two-way matchup between Bush and Kerry. Kerry now has a seven-point lead, which puts it just outside the margin of error. It's much less. It's about 4 points with Nader in the picture, so statistically a dead heat. But even more than the headline figures about the matchup between the two presidential candidates, what we're really seeing is a long-term slide which has turned quite dramatic in terms of the president's numbers on Iraq. In that sense, people are really moving away from where the administration is right now.
Also, it shows, I believe, that more Americans, some 42%, are becoming worried about how going into Iraq in the first place has now increased the likelihood of attacks against the U.S. That sounds like a pretty high figure.
It is a high figure, but they're also mirrored by plenty of others in our polls and other people's polls. The president's approval and disapproval rating on Iraq has really flipped over since September. It took a kind of blip with the capture of Saddam in December, but basically by about 50 to 40%, people disapprove of the handling of the situation in Iraq, and they're very skeptical that there's an exit strategy. So a lot of anxiety there on Iraq.
Now, how much of a role is television going to play here? Because, as you point out in your article, George Bush has spent about $40 million or so on TV ads in March. Is that helping him?
Well, you know, we get fascinated in the media by TV stories, especially at this stage, especially in the doldrums of a presidential campaign. You see a campaign spending a lot of money, and then what happens is reporters try and latch onto one poll or another showing whether they're effective or not. The early stories about Bush's TV spending, and some of those TV ads I'm sure you've seen, the early stories said that Kerry's disapproval ratings, his negative numbers, were rising. In fact, that doesn't seem to be the case. Bush has pretty much spent $40 million to move Kerry's disapproval numbers up by all of 1 point. That's according to the Annenberg folks at Pennsylvania. So a lot of money being spent, but I think what's really changing things is not so much the ads, but the hard news we're talking about this morning.
Mm. And do you get a sense from those poll numbers about how Americans might be defining success at this point?
Not a huge amount. There is when the numbers break down, we ask people, do you want troops out now? Do you want them out in a year? Do you want to wait until there's a stable Iraq? Other people have asked that kind of question. Basically, the public attitude, the appetite is for no more than about 2 years for troops to be there. After 2 years, support for troops in Iraq declines very, very sharply. And of course, that's not something that the Bush administration is talking about at any time. The line is, we'll stay there until the job is done and stay the course.
Although there is another number that seems very significant here, that 40% are very concerned that Iraq will become another Vietnam.
Yeah, Vietnam is obviously on everyone's mind now. Those analogies are never quite perfect. And of course, for a huge number of people we survey, Vietnam is a historical a piece of information they have no connection with, especially for younger voters. So it really varies according to the age group there. But those echoes are coming back, not just in the media, but in public minds as well.
Well, Richard, stay with us on the line, if you will. I want to bring Les Gelb into the conversation now. He is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's joining us from New York. Hello, Les, and welcome.
Good morning.
This is certainly a discussion that you have heard before in years past, and I'm wondering how well the Vietnam analogy holds up in your mind.
Well, there is an analogy. I think people are getting increasingly confused about why we got into Iraq in the first place, which is what happened with Vietnam, and they're even more confused and alarmed about how we're going to get out, which is also like Vietnam. But in particulars, of course, there are differences. In terms of the major impact in people, how they're seeing this, though, they see it as a quagmire. They see no real administration policy. So they're getting worried. They're getting alarmed. And the natural tendency to go along with the president, particularly a strong president like Bush, who seems so clear-minded about what he's doing out there, is eroding.
And are you surprised by that erosion, or does it seem to be the logical follow-on to what's been happening in Iraq?
I was surprised it took this long to happen, because as far as I'm concerned, it's been clear for months that the administration didn't have a sensible policy to deal with that situation in Iraq. But as events unfolded there, as you not only began to have difficulties among the different religious and ethnic groups, but as the Sunni Arabs and Shiite Arabs began to unite against us, as in the last 10 days or so, it became just overwhelmingly clear, I think, to the American people.
And yet, Richard Wolff, it's interesting that, 57%, something, a pretty high number of Americans say they still think it was a good idea to go into Iraq in the first place.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's really related to Saddam Hussein himself. People know that it was a bad regime, and seeing the end of a dictator, a murderous dictator, people generally approve of. You know, this is not an easy discussion for most people. The war is a very emotional thing. People are conflicted about supporting troops, but they also have their reservations. I think that the kind of complexities we see in the polls are reflected, for a start, among the political elites. There are very few people who have a black and white view of this war, or I think, frankly, any other.
And so how do you see that reflected as people answer these questions, and indeed as the questions are formulated by the pollsters? You know, you want to get at what people really think. It's not so clear-cut, as you suggest. It's not black and white. People do have a complicated response to it. So how do you get to, in a poll, that wide range of feeling about what's happening there?
Well, you try and divide it up into different things. For instance, do you think the administration has an exit strategy? I'm a little bit troubled by the Vietnam questions in these polls because I think it's a kind of leading question. As soon as you make the comparison as a pollster, you place the image in people's minds, and people are led by that. So some of the more interesting numbers, I think, are do you think that there is an exit strategy? Do you want to see troops come home? Because that really indicates, and of course, you approve of what the president's doing. That's crucial, obviously, for the presidential election itself and for the president's own numbers.
And speaking of exit strategies, Les Gelb, that's certainly something that that we heard a lot in Vietnam in presidential campaigns. Who was it, in fact, wasn't one of the presidential contenders, but somebody said that we should just declare victory and go home.
It was Senator Aiken of Vermont.
Right.
The people won't be suggesting that in this case. I think, except for, you know, people like Senators Byrd, most folks feel that now that we made this enormous commitment of American power and prestige to fight the war in the first place, that we would lose terribly in the Middle East and in the war against terrorism unless we made Iraq a better and safer place before we left it.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. Richard Wolff, thank you so much. I know you have to go, but appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about how the war in Iraq is playing in terms of politics on the presidential campaign trail. Where do you come down in the opinion polls? Do you support Bush's handling of the war in Iraq? Could Kerry have done any better? Is Iraq a deciding factor for your vote in November? You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This hour, we're talking about war, occupation, and the race for the White House. Do you define success in Iraq in George Bush's terms, in John Kerry's terms? Is there a difference? Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. My guests are Les Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, and John Mueller, author of Policy and Opinion in the Gulf War. John, thanks for joining us. You've been waiting patiently on the line and listening.
Thank you.
Are you surprised, as Les Gelb said he was a moment ago, that it has taken this long for public opinion to shift?
Yes, yeah, somewhat. I mean, it hasn't shifted so much as it's gradually declined. It has been the case that casualties have been quite low compared to, obviously, things like Vietnam. But there has been a distinct erosion. At the end of the war, most of the numbers were 15 to 25% higher than they are now. So over the course of a year, an erosion of 20 or 25 percentage points is fairly significant.
And what about the comparisons we're hearing now, certainly from Senators Kennedy and Biden and Byrd, about this is now comparable to the Tet Offensive, when public opinion about Vietnam shifted pretty dramatically? We're not hearing this so much from Kerry, we should point out, but from others. Is that a fair comparison in your mind?
Yes, exactly that, except they've got the numbers wrong. What happened during the Tet Offensive was that the gradual decline that was happening before the Tet Offensive continued. There was not a huge drop, and that seems to be what's happening here as well. Actually, some of the numbers are quite startling, or bigger than that, you might say, because CBS did a poll which came out last Friday, which indicated there's a 5 percentage point drop in both the idea that was this a mistake, do we do the right thing to get in, and also has it been worth it? And 5 percentage points in just a week is really quite impressive. So there is this erosion continuing, it seems to me.
And Les Gelb, remind us about the impact of the Tet Offensive.
Well, I think the professor described it very well. It was more of a shock to the system of the decision makers in Washington and to Washington politics than it was to the public at large. When Tet happened, it looked to the public like more of the same, more of a quagmire. We don't know how to get out of here. So there was a continued drop in public support for an understanding of the war. But for the leaders in Washington, it hit them in the head. It looked like all the improvements that they thought had been occurring in the previous months had just fallen apart. And it led President Johnson to decide to get out of the race and to reassess policy toward Vietnam. And the result was we stopped the bombing, began negotiations, and topped off our troop levels there. So it had a dramatic effect on policymaking.
And there's another comparison to be made here, John Mueller. You've written a book about public opinion and the Gulf War. Remind us of how this all played out in Bush 1, because there it was a successful war, few casualties, and yet he failed to win the White House again.
Yes, what tends to happen is that people tend to forget things like this very quickly. So that although it was a huge success, and indeed the fat lady sang, that is to say, once the war was over, the troops came home, the Kuwait government went back. There was a very messy situation within Iraq, and with the Kurds in particular in the north as well. But people didn't pay that much attention, and they shifted almost immediately back to things that they really wanted to be concerned about now that the war was over, which was the economy. And that was not, of course, George H.W. Bush's strong suit. So what you get is this happens fairly quite frequently that Churchill was voted out of office even while World War II was still going on. That people's the virtuosity with which people can shift their attention is quite impressive.
But go ahead, Les.
I was just laughing and agreeing.
Okay. Well, John, let's pursue that point a moment ago because. Most people, I think, if you had asked them a couple of months ago, would say that the economy was going to be the big issue once again this year, and that if the economic situation looked pretty upbeat come November, that re-election wouldn't be any problem for Bush too.
Yes, I think that's fairly much the case, and that still could potentially be the situation if they're able to stabilize the situation so that, in particular, there aren't very many American casualties, or even do a kind of a plausible pass-off in the middle of summer, which is, of course, the thing they hope to do. It could be that the war will sort of recede from people's concerns.
I don't think that'll happen, though.
I think that's probably right.
The downside on Iraq is much, much greater than the upside. This current uprising may subside, but it's set something off that we're going to see again over the next few months. And when you do have the transfer of power, and that's just, 10 or 12 weeks away, end of June, the situation is going to get even more desperate because there is no Iraqi government by any stretch of the imagination to hand over power to. So you're going to have, in effect, no political sovereignty in the country and American military sovereignty. A recipe for yet continued disaster.
Let's bring some of our listeners into the conversation now, gentlemen. We have on the line from Boston, Massachusetts. James is joining us. Hi, James.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, on these polls, you cited the Newsweek poll that had Kerry ahead, but I was wondering, comparing to other polls, there's a number of other polls like the Rasmussen poll, CNN Gallup poll, and the Fox News poll, the AP poll that show Bush ahead, and I was wondering how you compare one poll to the other, or why, or should somebody take all the polls and then take an average of the polls, the ones that show Bush ahead, a couple show Kerry ahead, and then what is the spectator is supposed to do?
Well, you're a spectator who's following them very closely, I can tell, James. Thanks. John, what do you say to that?
Well, you probably, it's wise not to take them too seriously, bumps up and down. This new poll was one after the Fallujah thing, so that suggests there's been something of a real reaction with respect to confidence in Bush. But they do go back and forth, and obviously the main thing is that this is very close, and So taking anyone particularly seriously is not particularly wise. I think the other ones he's referring to were actually before Fallujah, when Bush was somewhat ahead.
Yeah, I think the horse race between Kerry and Bush will go back and forth, but my guess is that public support for the war in Iraq will continue to decline, that what we're seeing there is a clear trend.
We've mentioned Fallujah a couple of times, and I want to pursue that because I'm wondering if Fallujah will turn out to be the tipping point here in terms of voter unease with how things are going there. Because even if you didn't see the pictures of the bodies hanging from the bridge, it's the kind of horrifying story that seems to resonate far beyond the actual number of people who were killed there.
Yeah, I'd like to extrapolate a little bit from what Les Gelb was saying earlier, that we may be in the position of going into a monumental foreign policy disaster, debacle. It's not quite clear yet, but there doesn't seem to be any way out other than the Aiken approach, which is declare victory and leave and hope people forget about it by the time the election comes around. I don't think it's going to I think it's a real problem, and people should be looking at that very seriously. I suspect from Kerry's standpoint, there might be some sort of way he could deal with this, which was his main advantage as far as the war is concerned is he's not Bush, of course. But beyond that, he's been talking about international support. And what he can say fairly accurately, it seems to me, is that if he's president, the international community will come back into the game, including the Arab states. I was just at a briefing last week about the Pew poll, about the way Americans are held overseas. Actually, a friend of mine just got back from Russia and was talking to a fifth-grade class, and they were all blasting him for his support for that he was an American. And the intense hostility toward the United States is very much there, and many of the Arab states, who could be obviously very helpful, see, as long as Bush is still in office, that they're next on the hit list. Iran, of course, is one of the axes of evil, and the various neoconservative types around the Bush administration have been, angling towards Saudi Arabia and Syria at the minimum, plus the PLO and a few others, Gaddafi and others. So from their standpoint, if Bush is in, they're next on the list. So from their standpoint, it's best if the United States really does find this a quagmire. So what Kerry could say is that if I'm president, these people will come back in and help us out. They will not help when Bush is in.
All right, let's go to Louisville, Kentucky now. We want to hear from Harry. Hi, Harry. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you. I'm a retired military officer, and I'd just like to comment the fact that this is just an absolute tragic use of our military force. Fine young men and women that are in the military are just being used for a reason that they should never have been used for. The military is an extremely blunt instrument of national power, and there's so many other instruments of national power that can be used before the military that, this mistake, and it's clear now it's coming back to haunt us and will in the future. And it's going to definitely influence my vote against the present administration.
Well, appreciate the call, Harry. Let's put that question to Les Gelb. I would imagine that's a concern a lot of people have.
Caller is right on. There's no question that I think the administration from day one has essentially seen power as military force, when military force is really the abdication of power. It is a blunt instrument. And if that's all you bring to the table in dealing with a complex situation like putting back together a society and a government that's been knocked to pieces, as in Iraq, it isn't going to work. What Fallujah showed was that military force, even our terrific military, isn't going to be enough unless the Iraqis want to do what we want to do. And while most Iraqis may want us there, may want peace and security, they don't want it our way. And our military force, as your caller suggests, won't be enough to make it our way.
Unless if the military, if families back home and troops on the ground really begin asking those same questions, how big a switch is that? How important is that in terms of American attitudes in general about this?
There may be the beginning of complaints from the troops out in Iraq. It depends on how many troops are asked to stay and for how long. But morale out there is pretty good. The troops are well led, and I don't picture anything resembling a revolt. You know, what concerns me more in this, again, looking back to Vietnam, is when you push the military up front and you, in effect, ask them to solve the problem that they can't solve, a number of the military leaders start to sound like political people. So you have some of the generals out there talking like members of the Bush administration and starting to back the policy rather than doing the military job. And that's dangerous. It's politicizing the military.
Could I add one brief thing on that?
Sure, John.
One is that there may be problems with reenlistment rates, particularly in the National Guard and Reserve. There's already concern about that, and you may have a sort of a hollowing out, particularly in that area, which might resemble, in some respects, the disaster that took place toward the American military, particularly the Army, after Vietnam. Not that extreme, I suspect, but nonetheless, it's potentially in the cards.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Back to our phone lines now to Cary, North Carolina. We want to hear from Rick. Hello, Rick. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the show. I want to say that I'm a lifelong Republican. I even admit to the fact that my first presidential vote was cast for Richard Nixon, ashamed to say. But last week I changed my registration to Democrat, and I'm going to vote for a Democrat for the first time in my life.
Because of the war?
I was leaning against it before. I just don't like the secrecy of this administration. I don't like the environmental policy, but the arrogance and the, you know, bring them on, you're with us or against us, that kind of attitude. I mean, you know, what do they always joke about the Axum, you know, never get into a ground war in Asia, and probably number two is you can't use the military to solve a political situation. And these people just don't understand that.
Well, do you see the Democrats offering any better solutions, Rick?
I think a bologna sandwich would offer a better solution, to be perfectly honest.
Can I ask where you're from, Rick?
Well, I'm originally from Pittsburgh, and I'm another transplanted Yankee into North Carolina. I'm a retired teacher.
But he's in Cary, North Carolina, so that's a problem right there.
No relation, I'm sure.
Well, I just... you know, as I said, their arrogance and this, it's just gotten to the point where I don't believe anything they say. I believe everything is, I believe they don't have an exit strategy. I don't think they thought this thing through. You know, this idea that they're going to go it alone and they're going to, you know, God bless America and all that, people would somehow rally behind them, you know, which they did initially. But treating the public like we're stupid, and if you just keep harping on patriotism and we're fighting terrorism and all of that stuff, and I'm insulted. I am insulted by the way they treat me as a citizen, and I am embarrassed the way they treat the rest of the world. I lived overseas for a little while, and you know, people would say, tell people you're a Canadian. Because if they ask if you're an American, tell them you're Canadian, because nobody hates the Canadians.
Can I ask your caller another question?
Sure, please.
Do you find that people you talk to throughout the week are discussing Iraq or terrorism? Is it a big issue to them? And
I bring it up. I'm kind of a gadfly. I bring it up all the time with people. And, people really are getting you know, disgusted. I'm getting the impression that the support for, I just talked to somebody the other day. He said he was an Iraqi veteran. He had come back from the from the war, and he said he was part of a Iraqi Veterans Against the War group. I wish I knew more about them. I wish I had time to ask him about it.
Rick, we appreciate the call. We need to move on, but thank you so much for joining us. And John Mueller, a lot of Ricks out there?
Potentially, yeah. One of the things he talked about being sort of being embarrassed and being insulted. I don't know how much that's affecting Republicans like him, though it obviously affects him. But it seems to be really affecting Democrats a lot. I've never seen so much hostility toward a president. And indeed, as far as I can see, I've looked at this only slightly so far, but I've talked to a number of other people about it. There's never been such a partisan gap ever since World War II, maybe since the Depression, between Democrats and Republicans. And the Democrats are, you know, one of the charms of the Democratic Party usually is it likes to rip itself apart in public. That charm is gone completely this year. They don't want anybody to criticize any Democrat. And, they move toward Kerry because he seemed to be the best guy to beat Bush. And that's all that really matters. So you have this intense hostility toward Bush. Some of that was even there before 9/11. A lot of it comes out of this embarrassment over the arrogance. Now, whether that's going to move independents or more Republicans, I'm not sure. We'll see.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We've been speaking this hour with Les Gehl, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, and John Mueller, author of two books on public opinion and the presidency, about whether war in Iraq will be a deciding factor in the presidential election. Has George Bush slipped in your poll over his handling of Iraq? Does Kerry's criticism of Bush's war policy get your nod, your vote? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR. And this hour, we're talking about war, occupation, and the race for the White House. My guests are Les Gehl, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, and John Mueller, political science professor and author of War, Presidents, and Public Opinion. And we invite you to join the conversation. Is George Bush or John Kerry more likely to be able to succeed in a place where Americans are being viewed more as occupiers than liberators? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Charles now. He's on the line from Pinehurst, North Carolina. Hello, Charles.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. So what's on your mind?
I just wanted to make the point. I think that there's going to be an interesting parallel. We're in a quagmire politically in this country, too. I don't think that it's really going to matter whether Kerry replaces Bush, personally, which I would like to see, but I think that we're so divided in the country right now that we're not going to be able to come to consensus on how to proceed further with this.
So what would be your suggestion? Do you have one?
I don't know. I mean, follow through logically. If Kerry wins the election, I think there's going to be so much resistance from the right that there'll be roadblocks thrown up for him, too. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. I just know I feel this is a vestige, a leftover from what happened during the Clinton administration. I think that any potential solution is being thwarted from the left simply as a leftover from that.
All right, Charles, we appreciate the phone call. And Les Gehl, let me throw that one to you and also ask about the polarization. The country does seem to be just incredibly divided right now. Not the first time, certainly.
I think the polls reflect reality. People are losing confidence in President Bush because they don't think he has the answers to the situation in Iraq. But they aren't flooding to John Kerry because they don't hear that he has much of a solution either. And that is reflected in the polls. John Kerry is in the awful position, as this caller suggested, of trying to figure out what to do with a situation now where there really aren't any good choices. I've been pushing the notion for the last 3 or 4 months of trying to work out a solution largely along ethic and religious lines, to let the Kurds pretty much run their own affairs in the north, the Shiites in the south, and the Sunnis with mixtures of others in the center. But I advance that with great trepidation because I'm not sure what will work at this point. The UN isn't going to be able to come in and take it over. We're not going to send more troops and pacify the place. So we are up a tree. And while people will look to Kerry for answers, and he might be able to provide better answers than Mr. Bush, they aren't going to be a lot better.
John, I'd be interested in hearing from you on this.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I basically agree with that. It's a real mess, and Kerry has the, as your earlier caller said, has the bologna sandwich advantage that if it's a vote on the war, anybody else is better than Bush. That's the way a lot of people will be seeing it. But it's a possible sort of precipitous withdrawal is easier in this case, I think, than it was in Vietnam. In the case of Vietnam, the problem with withdrawing was that the North Vietnamese held 500 prisoners, including John McCain. And there was no exit strategy that was feasible politically unless you got those prisoners out. Once the prisoners were out, after the negotiations had ended in January 1973, attention turned very much away from Vietnam, even though we were still somewhat committed. And congressional support for the continuing South Vietnamese dwindled extremely rapidly. So in this case, basically what you've got is a humanitarian situation. There aren't American prisoners. And so politically, one could withdraw. It would be seemed to be a debacle and a disaster by a lot of people, but I don't think Kerry is going to say, let's send the troops back in.
Right now, everybody is just repeating this mantra about staying the course, but the present course just clearly isn't working. And I think the real question should be staying what course?
Well, and also, isn't John Kerry in something of a spot here because he voted for the war, and he's seemingly having to walk something of a tightrope now because wanting to take advantage of the situation politically, obviously, but not wanting to appear gleeful about all the bad news that's coming out of Iraq.
Yeah, I think there were good reasons for the war, and John Kerry was correct in supporting it. The question is, and the question was even at that moment, were we prepared for the aftermath of military victory? And it's absolutely clear to everyone except those with their heads in the sand that we weren't prepared to deal with Iraq after we destroyed the Saddam regime. And now we're paying in increasingly large doses the costs of that failure.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's go now to Don, who's on the line from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hello, Don. Welcome.
Hello. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
I'm wondering, just listening to your caller there, what more could we have done to be prepared for the aftermath? I agree that it's a quagmire, but I think we absolutely had to do it, and we absolutely must finish it now. Exactly the definition of finished, that's still up in the air. We will at some point turn this over to an Iraqi government and bring our soldiers home.
Can I ask the caller, Don, a question?
Yes.
How many American lives is it worth to finish the job, as you put it?
Tough number to reach there.
Certainly.
But it has to be done. How many is it worth to not do it is the counter question.
Well, if it's 10 or 20,000 lives, is that worth it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think the casualties or deaths will be anywhere near that number.
I don't either.
But the real question to me is, how do you finish it in a way that isn't going to just continually drain us and continue to build up anti-American feelings in Iraq and around the world? Those are costs as well. As I said, I'm in favor of making Iraq a better and safer place, but we aren't doing that. The net effect of this policy, I think, is just to roil the different groups against each other and against us.
I believe that as we leave Iraq within a few years, we may need to go back again.
Oh, heavens.
I certainly do. Or the other option is to fight this battle in New York and Chicago and Atlanta, and I'm not in favor of that option.
But I don't think that even what we both might call military victory in Iraq, which we're not going to achieve, is going to stop terrorism against this country. You know, one of the major fictitions of the Bush administration has been that Iraq is somehow key to or center of the terrorist conspiracy against the United States. And while there may be some truth to it, there's no evidence that the Bush administration has ever produced to back it up. So I think we're going to be faced with terrorism, whatever the outcome, in Iraq. But I think it will be worse the longer we stay there and get into the business of killing Iraqis in order to pacify them.
John, we appreciate the phone call. John?
Yeah, so the logic of that is basically cut our losses and get out early. Clearly, if the we're going to lose anyway in the long run, the best thing is to lose soon and let them someone else figure out the mess.
I don't think we have to lose. I hope we don't have to lose. I hope we haven't reached that
point. You're losing
point.
Like Vietnam.
But quite frankly, I can't give you a terribly good answer on how to make it much better at this point.
Yeah, in some respects, the war has already been lost from a standpoint of terrorism. Whatever the United States does, it's going to be a sort of a partial solution. And many people around the world, the Pew survey certainly showed this, and Osama bin Laden has been saying this too, that the United States went into Iraq to control the oil and to dominate the Middle East. Neither of those, I think, are really quite true, but that's what they think. Huge numbers of that people think that in the Middle East. Consequently, even if it's a good scenario and the United States does leave at some time, it will not dominate the Middle East, nor will it really control, at least in the direct sense that these guys mean, the oil there. So it's going to be seen, whenever the United States leaves, as a victory of terrorists. So to that degree, it'd be somewhat similar to the Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon. You can make a perfectly good case that the job there was done and they retreated in a reasonably orderly way. But the terrorists in Lebanon saw that as a huge victory, and it was tremendously encouraging to the Hamas terrorists within Israel itself and within Palestine itself. So, and I think the potential for this being happening in this case is very high. If we really retreat in disarray, Osama bin Laden and other terrorists are going to see it as another Afghanistan. We're using terrorist tactics. This has been his position from the beginning. You can defeat superpowers. We did it in Afghanistan, and there's a real chance that something like that will be the case, or at least seen to be the case, which is all that really matters, by people like him in the Iraq situation.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Escalb, I want to pursue the point about Bush having been perceived as the go-to guy against terrorism. That's certainly his argument, and that's why he's urging the American public to stay the course with him, that he's the one who knows how to deal with terrorism. And I wonder how you see the impact of the 9/11 Commission hearings. How much is that going to play a role here?
It might play a slight role. I don't think it'll play a tremendous role or tip the elections or change perceptions of the American public in a major way. The arguments get very muddled and confused, and it's very easy to confuse things, and I think that's basically what the Bush people who've been testifying have been doing. But it'll be events in Iraq or terrorist incidents that will really shape public opinion on this. Now, Gail, do you mind if I go back to something John Mueller just said about the inevitable defeat, however we get out of Iraq?
Sure, go ahead.
You know, John Mueller really is the reigning expert on war and peace and public opinion. He's the best man to talk to. But I've always been struck, being a student of the Vietnam War, about how it ended on almost the worst possible terms for us, lifting American troops off our embassy rooftop with helicopters. And it looked like a total defeat, a total disaster. And within a few years, I would say the United States' position in Asia was stronger than it had been for the 10 years of the Vietnam War. The United States has great resiliency, and we would have resiliency in the Middle East, too, if we fashioned other policies to show that we were in some sort of harmony with the kind of changes that will be occurring in that part of the world. Not telling them what to do, but making it clear that we're basically on the same side. I think that we can make Iraq a better and safer place, not into a paradise, democratic, free market enterprise, but into a better and safer place, and restore a pretty good position for ourselves in the area. But we can't do it simply by leaving at this point. There's got to be another way of doing it that doesn't involve sending more troops or turning over power to a non-existent government.
Okay, let's ask John Mueller for a last thought here. Get your crystal ball out for a moment and maybe sketch out a couple of the likely scenarios you would anticipate between now and November.
Well, I think I agree particularly with the first part of what Les Gelb said, that the country is very resilient. And even though I do think that if almost any kind of withdrawal will be seen as a victory for the terrorists, I don't think that's necessarily all that consequential in the long term. It's a bad thing, but not the end of the world. And Vietnam, which I agree completely, was the greatest debacle in history, probably, of American foreign policy history, was basically written off very quickly. I was always interested, since I wrote a book about it, about how it would come out in the 1976 elections immediately after the debacle of 1975. And the only way it came out was Ford taking credit, President Ford, for having presided over the debacle. So I do think that even a massive disaster in the case of Iraq will probably go by the wayside within a few years. It's not the end of the world.
Well, we appreciate both of you being with us very much. Les Gelb, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Les Gelb is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, and John Mueller, thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
John is Professor of Political Science at Ohio State University, and earlier this hour I spoke with Dan Murphy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, and to Richard Wolff, Washington correspondent for Newsweek. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. You can continue the conversation online at theconnection.org. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR.